Hello and welcome
to the Local Economic Development Podcast,
hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Stammer.
For other programs in this series,
please have a look at www.ledcast.net. This episode is going to be different from our normal format in two respects. First, you're going to listen to different voices. This episode was recorded by Christian Schön, who is one of my partners in MesoPartner, and by Jonathan Mitchell, who is the head of the Propo Tourism Group at Overseas Development Institute in London. The second difference is that the episode was recorded in separate segments. Christian and Jonathan were recently involved in a joint activity in Vietnam, and in fact we have a separate episode that is addressing that experience in particular. At that occasion, they started to have a conversation on the topic of Propo Tourism, which they then continued subsequently using Skype. Now, part of that Skype record has a quality that leaves a lot to be desired, I must admit. However, I didn't want to cut it out because the content is very exciting. So from about minute 7 to minute 11 of this episode, you will find that the sound quality is not very good. But please bear with me and trust me, after that, it's going to be much better. Let us start this episode with an introduction by Jonathan on the subject of pro-poor tourism.
The term pro-poor tourism was coined about 5 years ago, just at the turn of the new millennium, when people began to get interested in the idea of the vast numbers of people traveling from predominantly rich countries to the developing world, whether this could have a developmental impact. And so we've developed within ODI in London a program of pro-poor development, which is basically looking at tourism and is in a variety of contexts around the world, is seeing what exactly the impacts on the poor are and how they can be increased.
So I understand that you had a couple of projects around the world trying to implement this pro-poor tourism activities. And I also guess that you used a couple of methodologies in order to analyze the tourism sector with pro-poor focus. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, some case studies from different countries and what methodologies you use in order to analyze and promote tourism?
Well, about a year and a half ago, we decided that value chains would be a useful methodology for analyzing the tourism industry. The reason for this is really that partly there's a general interest in value chain analysis, but also we felt it was particularly appropriate for an industry like tourism, where people within the industry itself see themselves as in terms of supply chains. So we've been applying value chain analysis for a little bit over a year in Africa and in Asia. The nearest spot to where we are in Vietnam that we've done this prior to the Da Nang study was in Luang Prabang, which is a very beautiful city in Laos, the country next door. And what we did there was to look at the tourism expenditure in the city, which was about $25 million US per year, and trace who benefited from it. And what we found, much to our surprise, was that an amount equivalent to about a quarter of that total sum went to the hands of poor people. We then applied the ideas to a different setting in West Africa, in the Gambia. And this really was a context where we thought that tourism was very unlikely to be pro-poor, because it was very much package tourism, package leisure tourism from the European market, particularly from the United Kingdom, and fairly low-end tourism, beach tourism, which traditionally has got a low level of benefit for poor people. And what we found when we analysed those linkages between tourism and the local community was surprisingly high level of benefit to the poor. And we calculated this was equivalent to about 14% of the total tourism value chain within the Gambia.
Could you give us some examples what kind of supply chains are concerned when it comes to tourism? And how poor people can be involved? I mean, are we talking about employment within the tourism sector? So that the tourism sector provides jobs for poor people, maybe low-skilled jobs, low-skilled labor? Or do you think of specific supply chains which are relevant for the tourism sector, or maybe a combination of both?
It's certainly a combination of both. The from the early work that we did in Southern Africa, which has a very particular labor market, which tends to reward unskilled labor well above the market clearing rate. Employment is by far the most important way that benefits are transferred from tourism to poor people. And this is through the employment of people in hotels and restaurants. In most of the rest of the developing world, where wages are much lower for unskilled and semi-skilled professions, and we're often talking about $1 or $2 a day, employment's important pathway for the spread of benefits. But what becomes much more important is the supply chains in agriculture and in craft. And this was really the finding that came from the work in Laos and in the Gambia. It was the craft markets and the food supply chain that accounted for a high proportion of those benefits that were transferred to the poor.
Jonathan, we look at the different supply chains feeding into the tourism value chain, particularly at food and agricultural products and craft. So let us start with craft. There's different experience, for example, you experience in the Gambia or in Luang Prabang in Laos, and also in Da Nang, where there are different craft products produced and tourism are expected to buy these products. But often they don't do for different reasons. For example, in Da Nang, because it's too heavy to transport the marble products, or for other reasons. Could you give us some idea what initiatives are done by local actors to stimulate the desire to buy those products by tourists?
Yeah, I think it's a very simple issue. Generally, it's encouraging local craftspeople to produce something that tourists want to buy. I think it's as simple as that, and I think that very very often craftspeople look at it from a supply side angle, where they're producing something that they think is beautiful and they don't understand why other people, and particularly tourists, want to buy it. And for instance, in the Gambia, one of the more successful interventions there was they got people from the body shop, the retail outlet in Europe, to go to the craft markets and explain how, you know, Western tourists wanted to see their craft presented, what sort of goods they wanted to buy. And it wasn't a case of then completely changing the cultural authenticity of the craft, but it was a case of designing it in a way that, and selling it in a form that would there would be a demand for it. I think the importance of the craft sector is simply that in a lot of tourist destinations, it's a lot of money. It involves often tourists are spending as much on craft as they are on accommodation, because craft people earn less often than people working in hotels. It involves very large numbers of poor people.
In terms of the product itself and their specification, can you tell us certain specifications of products that are necessary in order for tourists to buy them, or certain specifications that are rather inappropriate?
I think that places that have done it very well are, for instance, in parts of Asia where cloth is extremely popular, both for backpackers and for higher-end tourists, because it's extremely transportable, it's cheap. You know, you can get a very nice cloth scarf for $4 or $5.
And the design is often extremely distinctive to the destination. I think obviously the marble mountains in Da Nang, where you have 2 meter high marble lions that might weigh some 500 kilograms. That's the other end of the spectrum. But what I find interesting there is actually how sophisticated the crafters are in working very closely with export companies, so that when you buy your piece of craft, they can sell as an embedded service the delivery of that to your home address.
This brings us to another issue, or to another source of income. And apart from the income, the revenue from selling the products, the craft products, there are locations like Da Nang, but possibly also Luang Prabang and other locations where the tourists have the chance, the opportunity to see the craftspeople produce the products. And this is then also accompanied by food stalls and other ways of achieving additional revenue.
The opportunity provided by the sale of craft is to turn what's in a narrow sense just a retail experience into a much broader excursion, which can bring the tourist into contact with the crafter. And this is very much a win-win, because for the tourist it can give them a much clearer understanding of how the goods are produced themselves, how the craft is produced, and the cultural meaning embedded in them. But also for the crafter, I think one of the great benefits of having a longer interaction with the tourist is that they can give them a clear understanding of what the international market wants in the case of international tourism, which can help them both produce more successfully for the tourist market, but also creates the opportunity for them to produce goods for the export market, which can very often be a successful parallel activity with production for the tourist market.
So this is what happens at the places where the products are produced. For example, in the cluster, like the Marble Mountain cluster in Da Nang, or also the Bajang ceramic cluster close to Hanoi, also very famous, was supported in a cluster initiative by USAID, where the tourism element of the revenue for the meantime is about 40% of the total income. But apart from that, not every tourist goes to this place, because it's maybe not on the tour they are offered by their tour operators. So they just maybe are in the city or at the beach or in other places where they usually spend their time. And I think it's also a matter how the products are offered there. In some places they are offered by hawkers, rather by the informal sectors, or what we, for example, experienced in Hazyview in South Africa. What is your experience in this respect? So does it make sense to offer the products in various ways, maybe also at various prices?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the experience of Hazyview in South Africa is quite a good example of how not to do it in many cases, because in this context, very often it's imported craft that's from Mozambique and Zambia on the whole, rather than being produced locally. And exactly as you say, it's often hawkers competing against each other to offer goods, and often competing purely on price terms, driving down the price and therefore the returns for the sellers of craft. What I've seen working is where you can in a sense formalize the informal sector somewhat, and really a couple of things. I mean, one is to make sure that you're selling craft where tourists are, and it sounds an entirely obvious point, but for instance, make sure that the craft stall is right next to a large hotel rather than in a place where there aren't any tourists, because otherwise it's not going to work. So make sure that you're where the tourists are, but also make it a pleasant experience. And I think this is an example where either the being hassled by craft vendors often is counterproductive, and tourists that actually would be interested in buying some craft are just fed up being hassled, so they don't spend anything. But again, even in the example in Da Nang that you mentioned, in Marble Mountain, where the craft is being produced and sold in the same place, which sounds attractive, but you can't actually see the craft being made. All you get is the dust and the noise from the production process. And so it isn't actually a very nice environment to be in. And so tourists tend to stay for a very short time and then leave, rather than it being a pleasant experience and somewhere where you want to stay and spend money.
Let us look at the difference between supporting local linkages within the local economy and proper interventions. So we have cluster activities, value chain activities, local economic development activities in many sectors, in many countries, but not all of them have a proper focus or a proper intention. So where do you see the major differences between, let's say, a normal local linkage support activity and a proper intervention?
This came out very strongly in the most recent work that we've done together. I think that in many places it's actually the same thing. I think very often when you look at the local linkages in an economy in an emerging country, you find that a lot of those linkages are pro poor, and particularly where you're looking at linkages that move out into rural areas, that's almost inevitable. I think, though, that where you've got middle-income countries, and particularly where there's two economies, a sophisticated, capital-intensive, highly productive economy, and then a more subsistence economy, I think you've got to be very careful about which part of the economy your linkages are being made with, because in that context, it's entirely possible to have both a high level of local linkage in the local economy and to be pro-rich rather than pro-poor.
Let us look at local suppliers, including food and others, to tourism facilities, particularly to tourism resorts, which are also relevant in all these countries and examples we just mentioned before, particularly to medium and high-end tourism resorts. So what requirements do local suppliers need to meet in order to be able to supply their products to these kind of resorts?
I think there are a couple of trends that we can see across a whole range of destinations here. One very important theme is tourist safety, that increasingly the most feared people by local suppliers in a tourist destination in a developing country are the people doing health and safety audits for tour operators, because they're what they say goes, and safety standards are being increased as the cost of hurting a tourist increases, the financial cost, and can indeed wipe out a small tour operator. The importance of safety, particularly in transition economies, is very high and becoming more so. The standard answer in terms of how local suppliers can connect with the medium and upper end resorts is to look at the quality of what they're producing and the reliability of it, as well as the price. That clearly is an issue. It is the case that small farmers throughout, for instance, the Caribbean and large parts of Africa, find it very difficult to supply the quality of goods and the quantity of goods for a large tourist resort. Although there have been some very interesting initiatives where farmers have got together through cooperatives or other non-governmental initiatives to bring their supplies together and then be able to make an offering which, in terms of volume and quality control, is attractive to the tourist sector. But there's some work that's been done in Mexico that I think questions some of the conventional reasons why tourist resorts have not procured from local suppliers, which economics tells us should happen anyway. I mean, local suppliers that are near to a tourist resort should have a cost advantage over more distant suppliers. And the work in Mexico tells us that quite often there's a social or a political economy reason why the managers of upmarket hotel resorts really have no experience of dealing with local people and would rather buy from wholesalers in the capital city, quite often incurring additional cost simply because these are the people they're used to dealing with. So obviously there's an economic issue looking at price and quantity and reliability, but quite often there's also a social issue, a cultural issue.
So looking at wholesalers or large suppliers of, for example, agricultural products, we have also different examples in Da Nang. We experienced that Metro is a major player in this respect and is sourcing locally at a very small percentage and mostly from regions or other parts of the country. And I think these examples you can also find in other countries. Metro is a global player and there are other wholesale markets offering similar services. My question, what can, for example, local government as an actor that should be interested in proper policies and in most cases is interested in proper policies, what can local government do to encourage a large wholesaler to source the products more locally? And on both sides, I mean, interacting with the wholesaler, but also interacting with the small suppliers.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a couple of things that local government can do. I mean, what you very often find, and as we did in central Vietnam, was that although local government and departments of agriculture was aware that in the year or so since this one particular wholesaler had moved into the market, that the agricultural supplies that had very largely come from the local economy in the past, that pattern of procurement had been completely changed to the detriment of the local economy. What we found was that the Department of Agriculture had not even started really to engage with the wholesaler, which is important. So I think an engagement is critical. I think that it's also important that local government understands what's driving the decisions of the wholesaler or of the tourist sector itself. And rather than dictating and trying to require that more local produce is purchased, they look rather at the reasons for the particular pattern of supplies that are being used at the moment, and look for the rationale for that, and then try and change that rationale in favour of the local economy, which, as you were saying, will very often involve working with suppliers to help them produce the goods that are needed or improve the quality or the delivery characteristics of those goods. I think also just an additional point, what we found in central Vietnam was that government itself was imposing quite a serious constraint on the expansion of the tourist sector through its actions, not allowing or facilitating the coastal area to be developed, which is the great tourist asset of that area. And so you could envisage, through encouraging the beach developments, that the scale of the tourist sector would expand very rapidly. And so without having to change the procurement patterns of the dominant wholesaler in the area, you could increase the demand for local produce very significantly just by growing the tourism value chain itself.
What you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, there are different poor elements that can positively impact the income of poor people somehow linked to or engaged in the tourism sector, which is the human resource development. Can you explain in detail what exactly you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is really the case that I think in the past people have regarded tourism employment often as very unskilled, rather low status employment, which in many cases it is in the West. The issue is that in developing countries it's often quite the reverse. And compared with the prevailing skill standards and linguistic standards, it's very skilled work and it's highly rewarded. So the issue is how to reduce the barriers that poor people face in gaining the skills necessary to allow them to enter that the tourist labour market in the formal sector. And this is really where skills of the workforce are an important consideration for local government, because the situation, for instance, in the Red Sea area of Egypt, where there isn't any local human resource development around the enormous resorts around the Red Sea, all the labour will be imported from Cairo and Alexandra, because it can't be sourced locally. And so a major local linkage between tourism and local economy is lost if you don't have the human resources to allow the supply of adequate labour for this relatively labour-intensive sector of the economy.
Right, so we're talking about the labor market and through tourism development creating individuals who are more competitive on the labor market. We're talking about product markets like craft products, like various kinds of food products. We can't talk about value chains. All this is very business and market oriented, and it is an approach which is certainly very different to usual PROPOUR approaches. How would you justify to rather go for a market and business oriented PROPOUR policy than to the more traditional support of subsistence farmers or in many cases money transfer?
I think that there are several justifications. I mean, obviously there is a potentially a paradox between a pro-poor approach and supporting the tourist sector. I think this was best summed up. Klaus Langefeldt recently gave a presentation to the World Bank in Washington entitled Fighting Poverty in a Bikini. And I think that, you know, it's certainly an unusual and unconventional approach. I think the reasons for it are very clear. I mean, firstly, unlike agriculture, tourism is often a very large part of the economy, not just in terms of people, but in terms of money. It's a large part of the economy of many developing countries. Like agriculture, it's often labour-intensive, but being part of the service sector, it tends to be growing and becoming more productive rather than shrinking, and really, like a lot of subsistence agriculture, being a reservoir of unproductive labour. So I think the justification for looking at tourism rather than the more traditional social sectors of the economy and agriculture are that, in a sense, it's the future rather than the past. I think also the increasing interest in the tourist sector was reflected after the first generation of the poverty reduction papers throughout the developing countries, which had a very strong focus on social services. The entirely obvious point emerged after the first generation of these that to finance social services you need to have a driver in the economy. And that has resulted in the greater interest more recently in local enterprise and production, as well as purely consumption and redistribution. And I think that development practitioners have realised you've got to generate economic activity in order to have anything to redistribute.
So maybe you can finally give us some information where to find more information about PROPOUR tourism activities of ODI. I think there is a website which provides detailed information about international case studies, but also about the justification you have just explained.
Yeah, of course. We do have a website on www.odi.org.uk.
There, you already mentioned one website, your ODI website, www.odi.org.uk, but there is another website which is particularly addressing PROPOUR tourism, www.propourtourism.org.uk, and ODI is one of the authors of this website, if I'm informed correctly.
That's right. Yeah, at ODI we work with a group of other practitioners from outside the institute. If you go into the ODI website, there are links through to the PROPOUR Tourism Partnership, which includes a range of other researchers and academics who are working in the field.
Okay, thank you very much, and greetings from Da Nang, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you.